Welcome to Tentpole Trauma, the podcast where we look at movies that came with hype and high hopes, but left with crushing disappointment, either critically, at the box office, or both. Freed from the weight of expectations, we seek to examine these underperformers under a new light, parsing through the good, the bad, and everything in between with the hopes of gaining a better understanding as to why they failed to find their audience. Warning, there will be spoilers, so if you haven't seen the movie that we're discussing today, I suggest you stop the podcast and go watch it. Then when you come back and listen, you'll get more out of the discussion. On this episode, we discuss Willow. Sebastian, and I am here with my swashbuckling buddy Richard.
Hey, Sebastian. I wish I had a cooler response. I was trying to think real quick, is there like a catchphrase from Willow? But I don't think so.
I just wanted to call you the swashbuckling buddy because I seem to drag you on every episode that involves people running around with swords and adventuring. One of these days we'll have to get you out of the swashbuckling ghetto and into something else, like perhaps an action movie or something. But you're one of the only co-hosts that I think has a real passion for these types of movies. So I hope you don't mind that that's where you've been sort of stuck.
Well, I don't mind at all. I think I was the one who asked you if we could do Willow. So it's my fault. And I will gladly be the me-gosh to your Willow. How's that?
That sounds excellent. Before we get started, I always like to have you plug something you're doing. I have the pleasure to purchase and read Fear Book Club, which I really, really liked. I thought it was great. Are you still promoting that?
Thank you. Yes, I am. I'm promoting it all the time, even when others, including my publisher, don't seem to be. So yeah, I still have this promotion. You can find me on Twitter at RegardsRichard for as long as Twitter lasts. And if you just follow me and DM me and send me a proof of purchase, could be a picture of you with the book or your dog with the book, whatever, I will mail you a signed and personalized book plate free of charge. And it'll be like I signed your comic book for you without you even having to meet me, which is probably better for all involved. So that's still going on. Thank you for supporting the book. I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah, and I would encourage anybody who reads your book to write a positive review for it on Amazon. As a author myself, I know how important those things are. So read it and review it for our co-host, Richard.
Well, thank you. Can I do one more plug?
Absolutely.
I'm going to take a very generous page from your other co-host, Matt, and I want to plug something that's not mine. It's actually yours. It's your book, The Stronghold, which I think you may have mentioned once or twice in this show, but I've read it and I loved it. It's a great YA adventure. I feel like it's kind of like a more grounded Hunger Games. I hope you're okay with that comparison, but
I am.
It's really well written, and it was just a really good read. I mean, it. I think I finished it in one or two sittings and just loved it. So I hope there's more of those to come. But in the meantime, everyone should find that one on Amazon. I know for sure that's where it is. You may have it on some other platforms too.
We do. Yeah, it's up on a lot of platforms. And yeah, I mean, I'm a little self-conscious about promoting my own writing on the show, mostly because I sort of roll my eyes when other podcasts I listen to do that. Like, oh boy, another writer. Yeah. Here we go. But I am proud of the book. I've been told it's a real page turner, which I take as a compliment, and I'm really glad you enjoyed it, and thanks for reading it.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
But we're not here to talk about The Stronghold today. We're here to talk about Willow, the 1988 high fantasy film written and sort of created by George Lucas and directed by Ron Howard. And as you might guess, the reason why we're talking about Willow this month is because there is a new Willow Disney Plus series, I think to everyone's sort of shock and surprise, since this movie didn't exactly do that great at the box office back in 1988. Both you and I have watched some of it and have some thoughts, so we'll get to that at the end of the podcast. But first, Richard, what is your history with the film Willow?
Well, I remember seeing it in theaters when it came out. My dad took me, as he took me to see, you know, kind of most cool movies that were coming out. And I remember really looking forward to it. I remember, I guess, seeing the trailers before other movies in 88 and all the TV spots and being really excited. You know, they had a lot of Val Kilmer doing kind of his sword play in the thing where Willow says, "You are a great swordsman." And then Mad Mardigan like slips on the snow and falls over. And it was funny.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, it was right up my alley. I mean, I guess I would have been 10 at this time. I had not read Lord of the Rings. I hadn't seen the animated version. I kind of knew nothing about the classic fantasy stuff that I think is fair to say inspired a lot of Willow.
Yeah.
So I came into it with fresh eyes and I loved it. Probably saw it a couple times in the theater. I'm sure I saw it a bunch when it was on HBO. And then it kind of disappeared for a while, didn't it?
It did, for sure.
Yeah. It was probably about 5 years ago. I was like, boy, I really loved that movie. I'd love to show it to my kids. And I couldn't find it anywhere. I don't know if you know, it would have been after Disney had bought Lucasfilms. I don't know if they put it in the vault or a moratorium on it. It was before it premiered on Disney Plus again. So I just started doing all these deep dives and learning about it. I even tried reading the three books that George Lucas and Chris Claremont published after Willow that were supposed to be a continuation of the movie. But
that's right.
They're not great. I think they've been rejected by most fans of the movie because it really does do away with everything that's charming and wonderful about the movie. And they're just a real slog to read. And I think at this point, even George Lucas has kind of distanced himself from it, which tells you a lot for him to distance himself from anything that he's done. Wow. And I think, you know, his excuse was that he wrote the outline and he gave it to Chris Claremont. Chris Claremont was famously an X-Men writer for a big chunk of it.
I am a fan of his run of the X-Men for sure.
Oh, for sure. Me too. So I was, you know, it sounded like a match made in heaven for me, but I just don't think it was a good fit. And, you know, I think George Lucas said he was busy doing other projects. And then the books came out and he was, I guess, surprised that I don't know how he could have been surprised by them. I mean, I know he gave Chris Claremont the outline and Claremont wrote the books, but surely George Lucas read the drafts before they were printed.
I wouldn't say surely. He's sort of famously permissive when it came to what is now the Star Wars Legends books, which at the time when they first came out, they've been decanonized now, but when they first came out, those were considered canon. He said that, you know, these Star Wars stories following the original trilogy were what happens. And, you know, there was a lot of those books, and I don't think he ended up reading a lot of them. So when he got around to finally making the prequels, there was, of course, like information that didn't line up and well in the books or whatever. So right. He was like, oh, they're not really canon. So he's very quick to throw out novels in particular.
Yeah.
So it doesn't surprise me that he disowned them. It was probably, like you said, just a matter of the tone not being right or something like that. You know, I mean, you can follow somebody's outline to the letter and still not get the tone of it. It's all in the delivery.
Definitely. And yeah, I just also think like the writing style that Chris Claremont employed was kind of dense. You know, it wasn't like having an Alan Dean Foster write these things. But anyway, they're out there for people who are true diehard fans of Willow. And I feel like I've given you the longest answer to your question. I like Willow. I saw it opening weekend. I'm happy to be talking about it with you now.
I did not see Willow opening weekend. I was a little too old. I had sort of aged out of this demographic. I did still have a love for fantasy movies and stuff, but it became sort of closeted at that point. I was too busy being a cool rock and roll guy to go and see this light fantasy film in the theater. But I do remember watching it on HBO pretty much as soon as it showed up. And what I remember feeling was mostly bored, but I did like the Val Kilmer character a lot. And I remember even seeing him in it, I immediately recognized him as somebody who would make for a good, you know, leading man, which he kind of went on to do. I would say this movie, in a way, is sort of his first step towards being the leading man that he would become in the 90s. So it did make an impression on me, but as a whole, I didn't fully love it or anything. I did enjoy the special effects. I liked the dragon scene and stuff like that. But was definitely pretty cool on it when I first saw it. And that had a lot to do with the age that I was. I have since come back to it, though, several times. And I've sort of grown more of an appreciation for it over the years. How do you feel about its director, Ron Howard?
This is probably my favorite Ron Howard movie, which is maybe a little bit of a backhanded compliment. Like, I think he's a fine director, but I don't know, like, if I saw a movie that he directed and his name wasn't on the credits, I couldn't tell you it's a Ron Howard movie, necessarily.
Yeah, he's sort of a director without a personality, in a way. I hate to say it that way, but that's sort of how I feel about him.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, he's obviously had a pretty great career out of it, and I like a bunch of his movies. You know, was it Apollo 13's a good one?
Yeah.
He's had plenty of good ones. But for me, for my tastes, this is my favorite one. And I think there are long stretches of it where it's kind of a little boring. But, you know, when some of the action kicks up, like in the big siege at Tir Isleen, I think it's really exciting. And I think there's like some really fun set pieces in there.
It's funny because I do feel like it's one of his earlier films, and I do feel like he's sort of letting George Lucas take the lead in a lot of ways. I mean, as did the directors for The Empire Strikes Back and especially Return of the Jedi, they were sort of, you know, guys for hire because George just had too much on his plate to actually be directing the films himself. I don't think he particularly loves directing actors either, as the prequels have shown us.
Yeah.
I don't think he has a real way with actors. So I think at that point in his career, he was happy to delegate the directing duties to other people. And I do feel that Ron Howard here is really, you know, I'm sure he's really directing the film. I'm not trying to imply that he's taking a back seat to George Lucas, but I do feel that he's sort of intentionally doing things the way George probably wants them done, so that it has that sort of almost Star Wars-y feel. So, yeah, I do think it's sort of an odd duck in his canon, just because I feel like he's kind of mimicking George's directorial style and possibly doing it better. Like, I'd honestly rather have had Ron Howard directing the prequels than George Lucas.
Yeah, yeah. Anyone else would have been fine.
Well, let's get into the plot of Willow. It is a high fantasy film, very clearly influenced by Lord of the Rings. And we were sort of talking about this in the Zardoz conversation, and that is that, you know, there were a lot of people sort of jockeying to make Lord of the Rings for a long time. And I think on some level, George Lucas kind of wanted his stab at Lord of the Rings. And, you know, the rights weren't available to him, or maybe he didn't even really want to, like, literally take them on. But there's so much of this movie that is obviously influenced by Lord of the Rings, most importantly being the fact that the main character here is, you know, the least likely hero you can imagine, you know, specifically one of diminished stature, as in Lord of the Rings. Here we get the main character played by Warwick Davis, who is very young at the time. He was roughly my age at that time. And so, you know, he was only like 17 or 18, and he's, you know, headlining a giant movie. So I have to give him a lot of credit as an actor. I think he does a really admirable job of carrying this movie on his shoulders.
I agree. I didn't realize at the time that I saw it that that's Wicket the Ewok.
Yep.
And I guess that's how we met George Lucas. But he's great. And I only learned just before recording this that he was 17 when he shot the movie. So he was just a couple years older than the kids who were actually playing his kids in the movie.
Right.
I believe him throughout. I think he's actually a really good actor.
He feels like he's really kind of confident right out of the gate as an actor. And he really sells the character. But before we get into that, I would like to address the sort of central engine of this movie, which is this prophecy, okay? This prophecy is that there's going to be this child born, and this child is going to be the one who thwarts this evil sorceress Bav Morda, played by the great Jean Marsh. You know, we get a little text crawl explaining some of this, and then, you know, as with all fantasy films, and then, you know, we get this opening sequence where this child is being born to this peasant woman, and then her, you know, nanny or whatever is hiding the baby from the evil queen who's going around looking for it with her two henchmen, one of which is Sorsha, her daughter, played by Joanne Whaley, and Kale, who's basically a guy in a skull mask, and I don't know who the actor is. So the idea is that this child's going to be born, right? And sort of in a typical prophecy like this, the child would be born and you'd want to kill the child because it's going to grow up to be the person that overthrows your evil regime, correct? Right? You know,
correct.
This is the Snow White, this is your sort of fairy tale trope. But the funny thing about the way things play out in this movie is the baby is always a baby. I mean, I get it. She wants to kill the baby before it grows up. But because the baby's just a baby, like, is this really that important right this second? I mean, I know we're trying to do like a kill Hitler when he's in the cradle kind of situation. But, you know, like the baby literally isn't going to kill this evil sorceress until she rises up to become a princess, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's probably a version of this story where the baby, Alora Dannon, goes into hiding.
Right.
Then the story picks up 15 years later or 13 years later, and she's a girl, and now she's coming into possession of her powers and becomes a real threat to Bav Morda.
That's kind of what I'm getting at.
Yeah, for whatever reason, they didn't go that way. I've read sort of like alternate versions of the screenplay. The writer was Bob Dolman, who I think was more of a TV comedy writer and had met Ron Howard on some projects and somehow got this kind of plum gig to write Willow. And he was just sort of along for the journey. And I actually like his writing in this quite a bit. I think he humanizes a lot of these fantasy tropes that sometimes seem a little arch or a little stodgy and sometimes a barrier for entry for people who aren't like huge high fantasy fans.
Yeah.
But in none of those other versions did they ever do what you and I were just talking about. It's always Alora Dannon being the baby. And I think there's also something to, I think it's a little buried in some throwaway lines, but I think she has to be killed as a baby and there's like a certain ritual.
Right.
And that's why, you know, when you start to see some of that at the end of the movie, but it, you know, has to be done at daytime and a bunch of things have to be done in a certain way in order for the baby to be killed and not be a threat to Bav Morda down the road. So I don't know. I guess we just have to roll with it.
Well, yeah, and that would have been helpful, I think, to know that then. My, you know, analytical brain is asking myself, like, how is this baby specifically a threat? Like, I get the concept that she could grow up to be a threat, but in this moment, essentially the baby is just a MacGuffin. However, I have to give it to this baby. Like, this baby's reaction shots are like A+. Like, this baby
super
does
cute.
So much acting like in this movie. They get really great reaction shots from this baby, and the baby is very, very cute.
I think she's a big help tonally too, because some parts of the story get quite dark, but then you do a cutaway to the baby, you know, pouting or making kind of like a confused look, and it kind of helps clue me in on how I should feel in that scene.
Well, and you can see why Willow and his family would fall in love with this baby. The baby goes down the river, Moses style, right? and ends up at this Nelwyn village. Nelwyns are essentially hobbits, just renamed to avoid copyright infringement, I think. So the baby arrives on this river, and Willow's out there with his kids. We meet the character of Willow and his two kids, and we meet his wife, Kaya. Now, I do feel like this is one sort of moment where you can tell that Warwick Davis is much younger than he's supposed to be in this movie, because, and this is no shade on the actress who plays Kaya. She's a perfectly good actress, but she just clearly looks older. She looks like she's probably in her 30s.
Yeah.
And it sort of gives it away that Warwick is a younger person. I mean, it should be said that they are employing little people actors here. This whole Nelwyn village is going to be populated by little people actors. I noticed Tony Cox in there. If you are a Bad Santa fan, he's in there as a minor character. But I do have to talk about my favorite Nelwyn, and that is my boy Burglecut. I don't know the name of this actor, but every time he storms into the scene to bully Willow, I am just all smiles. He is just such a big, no pun intended, jerk. I just love me some Burglecut, and I just love the name Burglecut. Kudos to whoever came up with that.
No, it's perfect, and he's a great antagonist, and he gets his comeuppance a couple times in the story, and it's always really enjoyable. His reactions are great.
My only complaint about Burglecut is I wanted Burglecut through the whole movie. Like, I would have much rather had Burglecut as our comic relief character, as opposed to some that we'll get in a little bit, who I'm not such a fan of. Yeah, I'm just bummed that Burglecut, like, basically fucks off around the 40-minute mark. I see why he does, considering his cowardly nature and the dictates of the story, but I'm just wanted me some more Burglecut. The character of Migosh, who you referenced, is here. He's like Willow's best friend. But best of all, we're going to meet the High Alwyn, who is sort of the village wizard, right? Played by Billy Barty, the great Billy Barty. And if you were a kid growing up in the 70s or the 80s and you saw movies that featured little people, almost invariably they would have Billy Barty in there, because he's just such a magnetic presence and his voice is just so amazing. He's perfectly cast as this character.
Yeah, he's really fun. I guess the backstory for Willow is that he's a farmer, but he's sort of an aspiring magician, and he wants to be the High Alwyn's apprentice. And so that's kind of what he's getting ready for when we first meet him. They're kind of like having a big fair in the town. Willow does some sleight of hand magic that's pretty impressive. And then he does a trick with the disappearing pig that looks pretty cool. But then the pig runs out from underneath his little table or stage. And so you see that was just sleight of hand, not real magic. But I think there's kind of a fun sequence where they're actually testing Willow and two other villagers to see if any of them are going to be the new apprentice for the wizard. And Willow gets close, but he fails too. And I think Billy Barty's really fun in that scene and just very credible as like a wizened old wizard.
It's funny because, you know, we're setting up this character of Willow as being this aspiring wizard, or they call them sorcerers in the movie.
Right.
You know, clearly he doesn't really have that skill. And I mean, I feel like that question is going to be sort of the question for his character throughout most of the movie. Like, is he really qualified for this job or not? But I do enjoy the fact that Billy Barty's character, even though he definitely seems to have command of some real magic, is in himself not the world's greatest wizard.
Forget the bird, follow the river.
He summons a bird to try to send them on their quest, and the Burglecut humorously points out that the bird's heading back to the village, so that's where they should all go. And then Billy Barty tells him just to ignore the bird. It's great.
Yeah.
So yeah, the inciting incident is that Bav Morda has set out these, I don't know, devil dogs, hellhounds, whatever you want to call them. I forget what they call them in the movie. They're fun because they're clearly real dogs just wearing costumes, essentially.
what patient dogs to just sit there obediently when all these prosthetics are applied to them.
I'm sure the dogs were very well trained, but I also am sure that this was a real headache. You know, George Lucas is just counting the days to where he can make digital creatures, like dealing with these dogs and costumes.
I think there are some digital death dogs in the Willow show on Disney Plus, so he got his wish.
But yeah, so there's this dog attack in the village, and they do manage to kill the dog, but you know, they have a meeting of the council, and they know that they have to send people away with this baby, because clearly the dogs were after the baby, and yeah, that sends us on our journey. But I think this is all of solid fantasy setup. I mean, the whole movie, I would say, has a sort of generic quality to it. It feels kind of like things taken from a lot of different fantasy stories and put into one. But that was sort of the way things were done at the time. Legend has a sort of similar vague fantasy, generic fantasy thing. I definitely could appreciate it for the time. Looking back on it now that we have Lord of the Rings and stuff, though, it does feel a little quaint.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, not to jump ahead too much, that it's probably going to sort of be my big thing I'll go back to throughout this conversation when we're talking about Willow, but I'm trying to go back to the mindset of me being like 10 years old and seeing this, and again, having no exposure to Lord of the Rings, and really like the only other fantasy stuff I'd probably seen at that point was Krull, which we talked about on here.
A great film.
Great film, has a great James Horner score, just like this one does.
That's right.
Which kind of elevates everything. But so for me being that kid, I didn't know about any of those other things. So this was all like new to me, and I thought it was neat. You know, I didn't know about the Shire. And so the Nelwyn Village, you know, just seemed really well designed to me in hindsight, and looking back at like how great the Shire looks in the Peter Jackson films. Yeah, this doesn't quite hold up, but I like it. And I like you said, I believe that Willow and his family care about this baby that just sort of wound up in their laps. And I'm with him on this journey, and I'm heartened whenever his friend Migosh says he's going to go along with him, even though it's this really dangerous voyage out of the safety of their village and out into the realms of the Daikini, which are, you know, just, I guess, the human characters.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm with it. I'm ready to go. So I guess sort of like this fellowship of Nelwyns are now going out to the Daikini crossroads to drop off the baby to the first Daikini they see.
Well, shall we get right to our main man, Mad Mardigan, then?
Yes, please.
So yeah, they arrive at this sort of creepy crossroads where we find these crow cages, they're called, those cages where they would put people in the Middle Ages to basically die. And, you know, there's some skeletons in one, and the Nelwyns are sort of spooked. They hear like a noise or something, and Willow backs into the cage, and he is grabbed from behind by the occupant of the cage, who is still alive, and is Mad Mardigan, who is essentially our Han Solo, our leading man, who's not really the leading man because Willow's the leading man. And he is very memorably played by Mr. Val Kilmer. Here's where the movie starts to really appeal to me personally, just because I love this kind of character. I think Val Kilmer is doing a great Harrison Ford, but his own sort of spin on it. You know, he's obviously a shifty dude. He's, you know, not really a hero. He's calling the Nelwyns Peck, which is clearly a derogatory term, and they don't like it, but he just won't stop saying it and demanding for them to give him water and to let him out of the cage. How are you feeling when Val Kilmer shows up here?
I love Val Kilmer. And as a kid, I knew who he was. I had seen Top Gun, Top Secret, and my favorite, Real Genius. And so I knew who he was, and I knew he was funny. I just love like how conniving he is when you first meet him. Like, he tries every tactic to get out of the cage. He tries to threaten him. He pleads with him. He plays a sympathy card. And he's just really funny and charming throughout. Like, I don't know if this movie works without Val Kilmer.
I would argue that it didn't. It desperately needs this character, and they know it, and they've calibrated it well. I mean, we're about 30 minutes into the movie at this point when he shows up, which is like right where you feel that you need him. And what's great about this setup is their whole mission is to just hand this baby off to the first tall person they can find. And this is the guy they find. And he's in a cage. Yeah. And then even some soldiers from the opposing army, the army that's opposing Bath Morda, which is something I don't fully understand in the movie. I get it. There's another army and they're against her or whatever. And then one of his, like, I don't know, old buddies is in this crew, Eric, who's played by this actor who is in Superman 3. Forget his name. Sorry. Mad Mardigan's like, come on, let me out of the cage. And this guy's like, nope, you deserve to be in that cage. Stay in there. So we know definitively, we have like confirmation from other sources that this guy should not be getting the baby.
Do you want to know a little backstory, which didn't make it into the movie?
I would love to know it, yes.
Queen Bavmorda, her army, that's the Nachmar army. And I'm totally blanking on the name of the good guy army, but that's where this Eric, he's the leader of the forces. And I think in previous drafts, and this may have even been cut from the final movie, but he was a member of that army and he deserted it because I think he didn't agree with some of their policies. And that's why he was branded as kind of like a coward and a liar and a, you know, sort of shifty character. Uh-huh. So that's a little bit of backstory, but I think he and Eric were really good friends before they had this falling out.
I sort of got that impression. You know, we're going to run into Eric later, and then later on after that, Eric's going to die, and Mad Mardigan's sad about it. So I feel like that sort of reads. I think what's a little bit fuzzy, and sort of intentionally so, is what did Mad Mardigan do to get put in the cage? I mean, gets called a thief. So was he stealing? I mean, it does seem like he was a deserter too, but I feel like they intentionally leave that vague because maybe they don't want to spell out too clearly any one thing that he did, because then we'd lose sympathy for him. That's my assumption. It doesn't matter. He's in a cage. We get it. But Migosh lets him out of the cage finally, right? And so they hand off the baby to Mad Mardigan and that's it. The movie's over, right? It's all going to be fine.
Yeah, and all the other Nelwyns that were with him, like Burglecut, they all pieced out a little earlier. Yeah. I think it was when they saw Eric and his army going past Mad Mardigan's cage, and they're saying they're going off to fight this war against Bavmorda's forces. The other ones are like, it's getting a little too hot out here for us. We're gone.
Yeah, I don't blame them for that. I wouldn't want to be around for that war. But yeah, so Migosh and Willow are walking away. They're figuring they're going to come home and be heroes. And then a hawk flies by carrying the baby. I was impressed by this hawk and its ability to carry a fake baby. I think it's quite impressive. It's a real hawk. However, here's where I'm going to start to have some real problems, because we are introduced to the characters of the Brownies, who I found tiresome when I first saw the movie, and I continue to find tiresome even through multiple viewings. They're definitely the Jar Jar Binks of this movie. Not maybe as bad as Jar Jar, but in some ways similar, because first of all, they've got these sort of offensive French accents for whatever reason. They are miniature people who are even smaller than the Nelwyn. I mean, much smaller. They're like about, you know, 3 inches high, maybe. They sort of disguise themselves as mice, I guess. I think that's why Kevin Pollak is wearing like a mouse skin, so that he's mistaken for a mouse if he's seen on the ground, or maybe I'm reading too much into it and he just likes to wear mouse pelts. And I love Kevin Pollak, all right? Like, yeah, he is a comic actor that I like, but now we're in like appealing to the little kid audience with these characters, and that's fine. I'm not saying that they don't necessarily belong here, but I don't know. I was never young enough to enjoy them, so I don't enjoy them. How do you feel about the Brownies?
I'm okay with them, just sort of as residual goodwill from seeing it as a kid, and like, it was funny then, you know, Kevin Pollak falls into a mug of beer at one point,
yeah,
and gets drunk and has fun, and another point falls in love with a cat. You know, classic kid comedy. Yeah. My wife, who was watching this with me for this recording, this is when she left.
Yeah.
This is when she gave up on the movie. So to each their own. I mean, I guess it's kind of a classic George Lucas thing also to have like, there's always someone smaller, there's always someone bigger, right?
Right.
So even if you feel like you're the smallest, there's someone smaller than you. So that's kind of fun. And there's sort of like a Gulliver and Lilliput thing where Willow and Migosh are tied up by the Brownies. And I remember liking all that as a kid. I mean, it's just, I think you probably could have cut these characters out of the movie completely and not lost much, because for much of the rest of the movie, they're getting left behind and having to catch up to Willow and Matt Mardigan, and they sort of miss out on all the action. I don't know that they like shift the plot one way or the other throughout the rest of it. They're just sort of wacky sidekicks.
No, they add a little bit of elements here and there. It's because of one of the other guy's love powder or whatever.
Oh, right.
He hits Mad Mardigan with it at one point, and that's what sort of triggers Mad Mardigan to initially fall in love with Sorsha. So,
I got some problems with that, but we can talk about that later.
Also, they're clearly the sort of C-3PO and R2-D2 characters, right? I mean, that's kind of the role. They're the archetypes they're sort of filling here. And I will say this, I think that even though this special effects technique is dated and this isn't how you do it now, I think for what they're doing, they look really good. I mean, in terms of like the compositing, you know, their compositing matches really well for this era.
Yep.
And they do fun things with, like, you know, scaled sets when we just see the two of them. They're standing in some, like, you know, giant scaled set. So I will give it to the special effects team. And I mean, I think the special effects overall in the film are first rate. You know, we're going to Phil Tippett and Dennis Muren worked on this movie. And, you know, they're from the George Lucas camp. They do great work. You know, we're going to get this kind of stop motion. It's this technique that Dennis Muren created that's like stop motion, but it sort of blends the frames so it looks a little bit more realistic. Anyway, I just think all in all across the board for a late 80s movies, I think the special effects here are as good as you would expect from a Lucasfilm production.
I agree. They hold up pretty well. It looks better than Crawl.
For sure.
That's my baseline.
It does sort of bug me that the way that Willow and Migosh are saved from this Lilliputian scenario is that this fairy godmother just sort of shows up out of nowhere. We get some sort of Tinkerbell type fairies flying around, and she's a real like Deus Ex Machina sort of character who just floats in and is like, don't tie down the Nelwyn. She's the one who I guess sent them to find the baby. And she gives Willow a magic wand. I mean, it's pretty typical for like a fairy tale story. And I guess what I'm sort of getting at is, you know, there's high fantasy and there's fairy tale. And this movie definitely straddles the line between the two. And when it kind of veers into fairy tale, I'm having a little less fun because that's just kind of not my genre.
I agree. I mean, I think now, like, this is the, what's the elf that Cate Blanchett plays in?
Galadriel.
This is the Galadriel scene, right?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, plot-wise, I don't quite get it. Obviously, Willow and Migosh shouldn't have left Alora Dannon with a caged criminal.
Yeah.
So I guess this is the fairy godmother's way of kind of like writing the course a little bit and redirecting them on it. I forget her character's name. I want to say it's Shalimar, but it can't possibly be Shalimar.
That is a 70s funk band, I believe.
Anyway, fairy godmother, yeah, she gives him the wand. It's a pretty cool looking wand, just like a crooked stick.
And this is going to be the magic item that he's going to use to transfigure things later in the movie. We're definitely getting the sense now with the addition of this character that it's more than just Willow trying to help this baby, right? Now we've got supernatural entities getting involved. Are they just trying to get the baby into the hands of the good people so that they can keep the baby safe? Like, what's the goal for the good guys with the baby?
I think now we're introduced to the idea of the character of Finn Rizzell, who is a sorceress who's very powerful but has been in seclusion for a long time. And so, like, when Willow and Migosh first left their village with the baby, their goal was just give the baby to the first Daikini you see, and
right,
that's it. You know, wipe your hands, you're done with it. But now they realize there's like much more at stake, and that this baby is really special, and that, you know, there's this great evil coming with Bav Morda, and the only way to prevent that is to get Alora with this sorceress Finn Rizzell, and then to go to the kingdom of Tiras Leen, and there's supposed to be a benevolent king and queen that are there, and that'll sort of be their stronghold, and they'll be able to stop Bav Morda from there.
Okay.
So now all Willow has to do now that he's got the baby back, just get to wherever Finn Rizzell is, and she'll take it from there.
That makes sense. That clarifies things for him, because that's definitely where we're headed. But before we get there, we make a pit stop at sort of a tavern because it's raining. And here we get Mad Mardigan's sexcapades. Mad Mardigan has already found his way to this tavern, and he's, you know, gotten himself involved with a comely wench, but her barbarian husband or somebody is coming home, and so Mad Mardigan has to dress up as a woman, and we have this, you know, comedic scene where the guy comes home and thinks that he's Mad Mardigan's her cousin or whatever, and wants to get her involved with their sex games or whatever, and so it gets kind of uncomfortable. Possibly not a scene you'd put in a movie in 2022 with the cross-dressing and whatnot. However, it is a good showcase for Val Kilmer's charming shenanigans, for sure.
Yeah, and I mean, this is like the stuff that Mad Mardigan does that I can't ever picture Han Solo doing, right? You know? So it makes his character a little more distinct. And yeah, Val Kilmer's awesome in it. They give him these big fake breasts, which we later find out are just like fruit. That it, when they're being chased, he just starts pulling them out and throw them at the bad guys, bonking them on the head with it. It's great.
I do appreciate, too, he's wearing this sort of pink dress that this woman has given him. And he wears this for, I don't know, a solid 20 minutes of the movie. At one point, it's like virtually all he has on is just the skirt. And he's shirtless with this pink skirt. It's a good look for Val in 1988.
He's got some badass boots that he wears throughout the movie. And I think that's what makes the whole outfit come together.
Yeah, this leads to a carriage chase action sequence where they're going to be pursued by Sorsha and Kale. It's Kale, right? Like the vegetable? That's the fearsome warrior?
Yes, but it's spelled K-A-E-L, and I think it was supposed to be an allusion to Pauline Kael, who's a famous film critic at the time who hated George Lucas.
Yes, I remember hearing that.
And I don't think this won him any favors. Yeah, so I guess like by now Mad Mardigan has laid eyes on Sorsha and thinks she's hot, but that's sort of the extent of their relationship so far.
He thinks she's hot, but evil. You know, he doesn't like her. He intentionally says, I hate that woman at a certain point. So you know that they're going to fall madly in love. And they did in real life, because Joanne Whalley would become Joanne Whalley Kilmer not long after this movie. So you may not feel the heat on the screen, but it was there, my friend. Oh, it was there. I have to say that I do appreciate this setup just from the idea that I like that our female love interest is coming from the bad guy's side. I think that's a cool twist, rather than her being some princess, or I mean, she is a princess, but she's an evil princess who gets turned to the good side over the course of the movie. Yeah, I like that she's actually one of the hench people. It's kind of like as if Darth Vader was going to end up being the one falling in love. So I think it's kind of cool just coming from that angle. How it all goes down is probably questionable.
Yeah. No, but the Sorsha character, when we first meet her, she's formidable. She's got a very neat sword with like the serrated blade, and she's a good fighter. Like she kind of kicks the shit out of Mad Mardigan a couple of times.
Yeah, I mean, a lot is being made these days about, you know, strong female characters in sci-fi and fantasy movies. And I think we've been doing that for a long time, longer time than people are giving cinema credit for. I mean, this is 1988 and we're getting a strong, like, kick-ass female villain. When people say, like, finally, a strong female character, I'm like, you guys haven't been watching movies very long. But yeah, I like her character, and I like the performance that Joanne Whalley's giving here. We'll save it for the end, but I think she's the best thing so far about the new show.
For sure.
Well, how do you feel about this carriage chase?
I love it. I remember thinking it was exciting when I saw it in the theater, and I still like it now. I mean, it's kind of the first action scene of the movie, isn't it?
Yeah.
And we're probably close to an hour in at this point, or 45 minutes in, something like that.
I think that's a problem, honestly. Like,
yes,
there needed to be a more kick-ass action scene earlier in the movie, like around the 20-minute mark.
Yeah.
I realized that, you know, they were dealing with little people, and there just wasn't probably a scenario that would make sense. But there needed to be something earlier.
Yeah, I mean, there's the Death Dogs attacking the Nelwyn village, which is a good scene, but I mean, this is like your first real rousing kind of swashbuckling adventure scene. And it's good. I like the choreography of it. You know, Willow's got stuff to do trying to get the reins while Mad Mardigan is fighting off the bad guys pursuing them. The brownies are, I think, hanging on the side, and one of them's pretty drunk. And the baby's just being adorable in the back, trying not to get killed.
Yeah, it's definitely taking a page from the Steven Spielberg action manual. And I mean, it's doing it reasonably well. Like, I mean, obviously, I think if Steven Spielberg had directed this movie, this action scene would be a real showstopper. And I don't think it quite gets to that level, but it's good. So why don't you tell me what it is about the Sorsha Mad Mardigan love story that you don't like?
Jumping ahead a little bit, Mad Mardigan is eventually captive of Sorsha, and they sort of have this antagonistic banter, but it's also a little flirty, which is fine. And then one of the brownies later on, when they're freeing Mad Mardigan and Willow from captivity, they hit Mad Mardigan in the face with that love dust. Isn't that what it's called?
Love dust, yes. That's what made Kevin Pollak fall in love with the cat in the bar.
But like, I guess the love dust is what gives Mad Mardigan... It's almost like it gives him the courage to say to Sorsha what he's feeling, but he's like professing his love to her. You're my sun, my moon, the stars in the sky, all this stuff. It's a really fun scene, but the rest of their romance feels very sped up.
Right.
Like it jumps some really important beats, and so it doesn't feel super earned. There is some stuff that they cut out of the movie that I think it explains it a little better, and maybe we can talk about it like when we get to the Tyrus Lean scene, because there's kind of clues there about Sorsha's backstory that explain her turn to the good side.
Okay, cool. Well, I guess the next major thing to sort of cover is the meeting of Finn Rizzell, the powerful sorceress that Willow has been tasked to meet. He has to go out to this sort of creepy, spooky little island and meet her, but he finds her to be in the form of a muskrat. And this is going to be something that, you know, it's going to carry on throughout the movie. It's up to Willow to use this wand given to him by the fairy.
Shalimar.
By Shalimar. He's got to then use this to transfigure Rizzell back into being what she claims to be a young, beautiful sorceress, right? So throughout the movie, he's going to keep attempting this and failing and turning her into a different animal. But I do have to say, like, this muskrat is pretty darn cute, and I do like the way they sort of animate its mouth to make it look like it's talking.
Yeah, it's really fun. It's still pretty convincing. You know, we had a character in Krull that changed into different animals.
That's right.
And he's after Gooseberry Pie.
Yeah.
So this is the next step in that evolution of those characters. And when you do start to see Finn Rizzell transform into different animals as Willow keeps botching these spells, I think we start to see like some of the very first morphing.
That's right.
If not the first morphing in movies. And by today's standards, it's pretty quaint, but I remember thinking it was cool as a kid.
I like the performance too of this actress. She's an older British woman, but I think her voice fits really well with all the different animals.
You know? Yeah, when she's a goat, she says, Willow. It's pretty good. there's a deleted scene in here. I don't know if it's when Willow is going to the island or rowing back on this little boat, but there's some sort of, I think it's like a fish creature or a fish boy underwater. That's right. I think you can see it somewhere online, but that, you know, basically the boat capsizes and Willow manages to get away. But that's why when he comes back from that island with Finn Rizzell, he's soaking wet.
Yeah, I think it might even be on Disney Plus. You know, they have like extras sometimes and they'll put in deleted scenes. I think it's actually up there because I know exactly the scene you're talking about. I have watched it. And it is extraneous. However, I love monsters. And so throwing a monster in there makes me happy.
Yeah.
I do feel like this movie is a little light on monsters for my taste. We're going to get a couple and a scene coming up. But yeah, I kind of like the fish creature. But yeah, do you have anything really to say about this sort of whole kind of chunk of the movie? It is sort of a lot of back and forth between sort of like camps. The exteriors are somewhere in sort of a mountainous region, so we're getting a lot of snow. This is in the segment of the movie where we get that scene you were talking about that was featured heavily in the trailer, where Mad Mardigan has the sword and he's fighting in the snow, and Willow says, "You're a great swordsman," and he twirls the sword in his hand but then slips in the snow. It's very charming. They end up on a shield, sort of tobogganing down the side of a mountain, and they escape.
Yeah, as soon as Willow links up with Finn Rizel, they're captured by Sorsha and her soldiers. They've caught up with them. And yeah, you're right. There's like a lot of kind of back and forth in this part where like Mad Mardigan says goodbye and then he gets caught by the bad guys and they catch the Willow and the brownies. And it's like they are going from camp to camp. But yeah, net, they have bumped into Eric and those other soldiers hiding out in one village, the Snow Village. And we find out that when they went to fight the Nakmar army, they got their asses handed to them. So it was actually a good thing that Mad Mardigan didn't go with them. I guess the one good thing about the pace, not being slow here, but sort of it being a little drawn out, is like I remember being a kid and everyone saying how great a swordsman Mad Mardigan is, especially Mad Mardigan himself. So I'm like dying to see him pick up his sword. And when he does in that snow village and he's fighting off a bunch of these soldiers, I just remember thinking it was really badass.
I mean, by today's standards, it's a little tame, but certainly by 1988 standards, it's some fun action. And I think that Val Kilmer acquits himself well physically. I mean, he looks like he can really handle the sword and stuff. I mean, the choreography is done in such a way that you can tell that there's not really any real contact being made anywhere, but it looks good. It's well shot and looks good.
It's bloodless, but you know, like you could tell Val Kilmer trained with the sword and he just was like, I think even cooler than seeing him kill the bad guys is him just twirling the sword around, and there's just a lot of flourish in his movements.
He's super fun to watch. Like whenever the action kicks in, he's, you know, your main guy for that, and I think he's really handling it well. The tobogganing with the shield kind of reminds me a little bit of, I don't know if you've seen Living Daylights.
Oh, sure, with the cello.
Tobogganing with the cello, which was right around this time. It's funny the way you watch movies from the same period, and you're like, oh, they did that in this movie. They did, like, these set pieces get kind of weirdly recycled. I mean, the same thing happens now, but like you were talking about with the transforming characters, like from Krull, like they clearly saw that in Krull where they're like, we can do that better.
Well, it just occurred to me, but to go back to the whole cross-dressing kick in Tango and Cash,
that's right.
Kurt Russell has to do the same thing to escape with, I think, a young Terry Hatcher. Right. So, you know, it was just in the air, Sebastian. It's the zeitgeist.
I like to just imagine that there was like a wall somewhere in Hollywood just covered with index cards with like different like set piece scenes, like tobogganing down a snowy mountain.
Yeah, it's like bingo.
A male character dressed as a female character. Pick one and put it in your movie.
All the makings of a real motion picture here.
So, I mean, all roads are ultimately leading to this castle where I think the good guys are hoping they're going to sort of shore up their forces, you know? And we get this scene along the way where Mad Mardigan and Sorsha are riding together on his horse, and he's, you know, holding her close, but now he's sort of come a little bit to his senses. The love dust has worn off, but he still has feelings for her, and she's, you know, angry at him and sort of accusing him of like, what, you said that your heart beats only for me or whatever. It's a good sort of romantic adversarial scene, which ends up resulting with her basically escaping from him by like elbowing him in the ribs and getting off the horse.
Yeah, and kicking him in the nuts too. And she kicked him in the face earlier. And he keeps bringing it up. He's like, I hate her. She kicked me in the face.
Yeah.
And he's talking about how he wants to break her leg. It's, you know, I feel like this is probably the Bob Dolman of it all, but it's like, it's just good sort of like romantic comedy banter, but, you know, a little more violent.
Sort of War of the Roses almost in there.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, do you have anything else to add before we get to this castle?
Tira Selene. Let's do it.
Let's get to Tira Selene. So as you were explaining, the goal here is they think there's going to be some army waiting for them here, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is, I think, supposed to be like the most powerful, you know, good kingdom in their world, their realm. But when they get there, it's totally run down. And it's a ghost town, except that what few villagers you see are sort of encased or frozen in this weird crystal.
Yeah, Bath Morda has gotten there already, and you know, she seems to be pretty powerful because she was able to freeze people in stasis. And, you know, later we're going to see her have the power to turn everybody into pigs. So, I mean, as far as being a sorceress is concerned, she's pretty badass. Here is where Mad Mardigan gets his cool new armor, which is, you know, he finds an armory.
This was and still is my favorite part of the movie. Like, it's a whole action set piece. And right before General Kale and Sorsha and all the other bad guys arrive at Tir Sleen, Mad Mardigan closes the gates and blocks them. And so while the bad guys are fashioning a battering ram, he's kind of fortifying this ghost town that is Tir Sleen. So he's like setting booby traps everywhere, right? With the crossbows, right, with bear traps. Kind of like the timeline of this is a little wonky to me, because like, by all outward appearances, Tir Sleen looks like it was destroyed decades ago.
Right.
Like, even when he goes into the armory, there's cobwebs all over the crossbows. Right. So yeah, it seems like it's been defunct for a long time. But, you know, Finn Rizel doesn't know that. Shalimar doesn't know that. Nobody knows that. So they're like very surprised when they get there. Just to give you like a little more of Sorsha's backstory, I think in earlier drafts of the script, one of those people that's encased in that crystal is actually her father. So her mom is Bav Morda, but for whatever reason, her dad was this good guy king of Tir Sleen. They never explain like how he and Bav Morda hooked up and if they had a divorce or whatever. I'm not sure, but obviously one turned out bad, one turned out good. And Sorsha seeing her dad in that state and what had happened to all the other people in this kingdom is kind of what helps motivate her turn to the good. So it's not all just love dust and Val Kilmer being super charming. You know, as a kid, I went with her being a good guy. I'm rooting for her and Mad Mardigan to be together. But I, in retrospect, you know, looking at it from like with 2022 eyes, I feel like her character got a little short shrift with that character turn.
Yeah, I agree. That would have helped.
Yeah, I wish they would have, you know, given us a little less of like back and forth between villages and a little more of those moments for her. Because I think they just kind of help her character and they make the plot of the whole movie seem a little stronger too. And at the very end, when it's a happy ending and they're in Tir Sleen, all these characters are outside of the crystal. And so you see her dad there in the background and they're all reunited. So happy ending.
I do want to make one minor nitpick though, and it's very minor, but Mad Mardigan is going to step in some poo and he recognizes it as troll poo. And so we're going to get trolls now. And though I do like these sort of like Cro-Magnon sort of monsters, like this is not what I picture in my mind when I picture a troll. They look like kind of monkeys or something.
They look like the thing from the Twilight Zone, the, was it, Nightmare at 20,000 Feet?
You know, totally.
William Shatner and the gremlin on the wing. Yeah. They're very unsettling as they're scaling the walls of the castle and, you know, when shit starts to go down and the bad guys have broken in and Mad Mardigan's fighting them all off, Willow uses the wand and zaps one of the trolls with it.
Yeah.
It does this really disgusting body horror kind of thing where it peels its own skin off. These tentacles come out and then these two heads start breaking out of like this weird...
It looks like a brain.
Yeah, it's gross. Willow kicks it into the water, and then very quickly it morphs into this giant two-headed dragon, which I think they called...
It's like Siskel and Ebert or something.
Yes, that's exactly it. Yeah, it's some combination of their names.
One head supposed to be Siskel and one supposed to be Ebert. Lucas really had it out for the critics around this time, didn't he?
Yeah, what's the deal? He had a lot of money and like basically had a perfect life and he just couldn't get past his hatred for these critics. Move on, George.
That's how it goes when you're super successful. It's like the one person slighting you becomes the like biggest troll, quote unquote, in your life and you have to go after them. I mean, they don't say it in the movie, so it's, you know, it's just sort of a behind the scenes kind of thing.
Right.
But it's a pretty cool dragon. So yeah, they have this big fight, but what happens is that the Kale ends up getting the baby and taking off with it.
It's the shortest end of Act 2 going into Act 3 ever. Like Willow kind of staggers out of the castle. He's bloodied and Mad Mardigan's like, it's okay, we'll go get her. And so they do. Now Sorsha's with them and Eric and his army, they've shown up too. So they've got a force now.
Well, I guess what happens first is they approach Bavmorda's castle of evil, right? And this is another kind of thing that I think makes this movie not feel slow, but feel a little bit repetitive. We've just gone from this one sort of castle setting, and now we're going right to another one, essentially, the dark evil castle. And like, I remember thinking about this movie, and in my mind, I just thought about that dragon castle sequence being the end of the movie, when it's really not. There's this whole other vaguely similar sequence. I feel like they could have maybe done a little bit to sort of change up the settings so they didn't feel so repetitive.
The castles look very similar.
But they get outside the castle to challenge Bathmorda, and she turns them all into pigs. So we get this kind of fun, you know, makeups of people like Val Kilmer wearing like a pig snout and squealing. And the sound design in this movie is fun, as you know, the case in most Lucasfilm productions. I recently got an Atmos system, and the sound is really good. You hear all sorts of ambient noises of different things. I heard a lot of Wilhelm screams in this movie.
Yes.
There's a ton of them. There's at least four, which I enjoy those. That's the canned guy that you'll notice in these types of movies. This is where Willow now must restore Ra'zel to her human form so that she can undo this evil magic that Bathmorda has done. And this is where we get our sort of CGI transformation. She's going from like an ostrich to like a tortoise, and then she becomes a lion, and then she morphs into a naked old lady.
My mother-in-law. Yes.
And so what we're going to get here essentially in this end battle is it's basically an old lady wizard battle is what it really kind of comes down to in the end.
Which is kind of neat. And again, to your point earlier, like it, I don't know if that was progressive or just like fantasy was always a little more there with equality than people remember. But, you know, I mean, this is like the equivalent of like Saruman and Gandalf fighting. You know, but it's two women.
Yeah, totally. It reminds me of that scene. They're, you know, they're even doing similar things. Like at one point, Bathmorda takes her anger out at her daughter and uses some magic to sort of throw her towards this spiked wall. But then Ra'zel stops her, and they're sort of, you know.
Yeah, they're shooting fire. They're shooting ice. At one point, Ra'zel has Bathmorda floating and is like twirling her around with the wand.
The special effects here are good. I mean, again, dated, but they hold up. You know, and while this is going on, you know, Mad Mardigan's fighting Kale, sword fighting him. We're getting a lot of just, you know, back and forth cross-cutting of this big castle siege and battle. It's all adequate. I wouldn't say any of it's jaw-droppingly great, but it all basically does the job. I do appreciate we do get Chekhov's acorn because right. Earlier in the movie, Billy Barty gave Willow a magic acorn that says if he throws it at somebody, it'll turn them to stone. And so Willow does throw it at Bavmorda. She catches it and her like hand turns to stone, but then her own magic overpowers it and she regains control of herself. So we get the acorn, but it doesn't ultimately work. What does ultimately work, though, is Willow's old magic pig trick. I do like this. I like that we go back to the thing that he was doing in the beginning of the movie, just the cheesy illusion of putting the baby underneath this blanket and then pulling it away and having it be gone, and that being the thing that sort of tricks Bathmorda. I'm not quite understanding what kills Bathmorda here. Like, she basically just gets really upset and like raises her wand or whatever. She's been trying to do this ritual to kill the baby that's taking a really long fucking time. Like, like it's taken her a long time to kill this baby, the whole climactic battle. But then, I don't know, these sort of red lights just kind of come in and I don't know, she's vanquished by her own evil.
It looks neat. I mean, there's lightning and there's red mist. She knocks over some bowls. Maybe she shouldn't have done that. I don't know. But I guess my headcanon tells me that because she believes that Willow has disappeared Alora Dan into a place where she can't stop her, that belief that she can't complete the ritual is what does her in. It doesn't make any sense.
It feels a little bit like the Raiders of the Lost Ark ending, where it's like you unleash the power and it destroys you kind of thing.
Sure.
but it's not clear. I don't really know what's going on, but the evil is vanquished and it's happily ever after. The baby is going to be raised by the loving parents of Mad Mardigan and Sorsha, and Willow gets to go home to his village, a hero.
Yeah. I forget, does he become the apprentice or?
He's given by Roselle, he's given the Book of Magic. She gives him a Book That's of right. Magic and tells him that he can study to become a wizard with it. So I think that gets him in the door.
He does the bird trick that the High Alwyn did, where he throws up the rock, turns into a bird, and the bird poops on Burglecut's head.
Oh, Burglecut. So yeah, that's the end of Willow. Now, this movie had a $35 million budget, and its worldwide gross was only $57 million. So
wow,
that isn't great for a Lucasfilm production. I'm sure they were hoping for Star Wars-sized returns. And the opening weekend is pretty bad. It was like only $8 million its opening weekend.
Wow.
So let me ask you this, Richard. Why do you think it failed?
Well, a couple of things. One is, I know we all talk about George Lucas now in sort of reverential tones, but like in 1988, to the average moviegoer, do you think they all know, like, this is the guy who created Star Wars?
I mean, they put it in the marketing. I don't know if it worked.
Because, again, I'm trying to remember myself as a 10-year-old. I remember them saying it was the guy who did Star Wars, but that's not what, like, moved the needle for me. It was, like, a fantasy movie with swords and the cool armor that Mad Mardigan wears. Like, that's what made me want to go see it. So I don't know that the George Lucas name was as big of a draw as they thought it would be, clearly. Yeah. And as much as I love Val Kilmer in this, and I think he's great as Mad Mardigan, he's probably my favorite part of the whole movie, I don't know that at the time, or at any time, he was a big enough star to open a movie to be the headliner.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, I think technically, across the board, I think it's great for its time, the effects, the sound design, as you said, the music I love, you know, the acting and writing I think is pretty strong. It still feels kind of like a small movie, and there are stretches of it that are just a little slow. I think it really needed more action up front to kind of hook people.
I have another theory, and that is that it's called Willow. Like, what the hell does Willow mean? You know what I mean?
The crawl problem.
Yeah, like, I think that people saw the title Willow and thought of, like, a willow tree or something. You don't think of, like, fantasy adventure when you see the name Willow. You think of a tree. I don't know. I just don't think it was evocative enough. I think they needed to come up with, like, a better title. And I think maybe they shouldn't have tried to sell it on the Willow character, you know? I mean, I think Warwick Davis does a great job, and I think it's a cool idea to make the hero a little person, but I don't know if that's your most marketable angle, you know? I mean, if the movie had been called Mad Mardigan or something, maybe it would have done better. I just think it's a bad title that doesn't give you any sort of sense as to what the movie is about. You know, I don't think that's the only reason, but I think that was a factor. I think people just saw the name Willow and were like, huh? Okay.
I mean, Star Wars definitely tells you what it's about right in the title.
Right.
And I don't know. I'm sure you're right. I guess I do appreciate, though, that they went with Willow. Like, that's the main character, and just the whole idea that no matter how big or how little you are, you know, you have this potential to be a hero. I think that's a really great message, and I'm glad they doubled down on it. I mean, I don't think it helped them in the box office, but.
Well, another way they doubled down on it was with this new show. Do you want to quickly give us your thoughts on what you saw of the new Willow show on Disney+?
Sure. I mean, as of the time of this recording, I've only seen the first episode, and the jury's still out, but it really doesn't feel much like Willow. It doesn't feel like a continuation of this world. The design is really different. All the characters talk in like a very modern way. I mean, yeah. You know, Val Kilmer as Mad Mardigan is talking like Val Kilmer, but there's, I think, still a little bit of stylization in the way the other people talk that have you feel like it's in keeping with fantasy films.
Yeah.
And I think it was you who said, Sebastian, like on the Disney Plus show, they sound like CW characters.
You think they're going to start talking about TikTok like at any second.
Yeah, it's just the mannerisms and the turns of phrase. So that takes me out of it. And at least in the first episode, like they do the Force Awakens thing where you don't see Willow until like the very last scene. So I'm not a huge fan of that kind of structure personally, but it is nice to see Joanna, Wally back in as Saoirse. And they definitely name check Mad Mardigan a few times in it. So his character's kicking around out there. But look, I'm going to keep watching it. But I was, I guess I was a little disappointed right out of the gate, if I'm being honest.
I pretty much feel exactly the same way as you. I didn't hate it by any means. There were things about it I enjoyed. I think all of the actors are bringing their best. I think Warwick Davis is still inhabiting the character well. I really think Joanne Wally's doing a good job. But I mean, ultimately, I didn't really feel like the story was really grabbing me. Like, I can't even tell you what their quest is. I forget what it is. They just have to go and get Willow so they can go do something. It just seems sort of meandering. And yeah, I'm not a fan of the sort of CW-y dialogue. And, you know, they're setting up some, you know, central romances that I think, you know, could be cool. And it, I mean, I like that they're taking chances and doing an LGBTQ sort of thing at the center, but I don't really need a romance at the center of the story to begin with. So I'd rather just be focusing on Willow. And I mean, I liked the character that's sort of the Mad Mardigan character.
Oh, Boorman. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's cool.
But I mean, I'll put it this way. The bottom line for me is that I am not willing to hold on to Disney Plus for another 3 months just to watch Willow before we get to Mandalorian season 3. I'm going to give in to the churn, and I canceled Disney Plus, and I'll catch up with Willow once I start up again in March. I'll, you know, watch what I missed. I'm sure they're saving Val Kilmer till the end because he's, you know, infirmed as it is. So I'm sure he'll just have one scene like he did in Top Gun Maverick.
I'll stick with it, you know, for a little bit. I mean, it does walk back some of the Laura Dannon prophecy from the movie, and, you know, some other characters like Finn Rizzell and stuff, they're sort of mentioned, but I don't know. It doesn't feel like a as direct a continuation of the movie as I would have liked. Like they kind of move some pieces around. It's not clear why yet. Again, I've only seen the first episode, so this could all be part of a master plan. But I think the first episode also kind of made the mistake of the movie where, like, it's very slow in the beginning. I will say it's got four very neat looking villains. I think they're called the Gales.
Oh yeah, they were cool.
They have very nice designs and they're scary. And that is a good sequence. It's another siege on Tira Celine. But other than that, it's a pretty quiet episode.
All right. You have anything else to say before we get you out of here?
No, just thank you for having me on and doing this. It was a joy to revisit Willow and talk about it with you. And also, how lucky are we that, you know, we have our gripes about the Disney Plus show, but what a wonderful world we live in where there's a Willow TV show.
Like,
I really loved this movie as a kid. I still love it now. And I remember being disappointed that there wasn't going to be a Willow 2 or a Willow 3. There weren't even cool Willow action figures in the 3¾-inch scale. There were just these little, like, metal, I think Ertl made them, or some, they were just like little stationary figurines. You couldn't do much with them. So it's, I'm happy to be getting something, even though it's not quite doing it for me just yet.
Right on. Well, I'm going to go turn myself into a pig and chill with my bro Burgle Cut and watch an old lady wizard battle. That about does it today for Tentpole Trauma. If you like what you heard, check out our social media presence on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Just look for Tentpole Trauma. That was easy, wasn't it? If you like us, hit subscribe and leave us a sterling review on iTunes, if you dare. If you really like us, head over to patreon.com and get involved in one of our fabulous tiers. You'll be glad you did. Want to communicate with Tentpole Trauma? Send an email to tentpoletrauma@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. And who knows, one day you may even get your email read on one of our shows. Well, thanks for listening, and we'll see you real soon.